Welcome to Coastal Conversations, a monthly program that deals with major issues confronting the nation's coastal areas, marine and Great Lakes. This program is made possible through the generosity of the Roddenberry Foundation. I'm Jerry Schubel with the Aquarium of the Pacific, and I will be your host. In our last program, we explored over-fertilization of coastal waters and associated problems of algal blooms and dead zones, areas devoid of dissolved oxygen. This is a national problem that affects not only our coastal marine environments, but also the Great Lakes. The opinion of our two experts, Paul Sandifer, Senior Science Advisor to NOAA's National Ocean Service, and Tom Schmid, President of the Texas State Aquarium, is that the problem is increasing in severity and in geographic extent, and that over-fertilization and dead zones may well be exacerbated by climate change. Today we're going to explore a problem common to both ocean coasts and the Great Lakes. The problem, or the challenge, is to enhance the resilience of coastal communities, both human and natural communities, to enhance their resilience to chronic problems and to events such as hurricanes, nor'easters, floods, and droughts, to make them less vulnerable. Again, we're looking both at human communities and at the communities of aquatic life that occupy the coastal zone. Here with me today are two experts on this topic, Margaret Davidson, Director of NOAA's OCRM, the Office of Ocean and Coastal Resource Management, and Laura Pettish. Laura is the Ecosystem Science Advisor in NOAA's Climate Program Office. Margaret, I want to start with you. A good place to start is always at the beginning. Define for us in common, ordinary language, not government speak or academic jargon, what we mean by resilience in the context of our topic for today.
Certainly, Jerry, and thank you for having us in this discussion with you today. The concept of resilience, if not the actual word itself, actually has long roots. You can even find it in The Art of War, which is a lovely little Chinese book from about the 7th century. And it's been found a lot in the engineering community as well as in the systems community, both people who study ecosystems and people who study things like IT and telecommunication systems. So there are many interpretations, and you ask for the context. It does depend if we're talking about disaster, risk reduction, or climate adaptation, or ecosystem management, or even community planning. The one that we tend to use here in the coastal community is the same as the one that's used by the Resilience Alliance, and that is the capacity of a system that could be a community of individuals, or it could be an ecosystem or whatever, but a capacity of a system to absorb a disturbance and to reorganize or to reboot itself while undergoing that change. Not snap back to what you were before, but to change and evolve quickly and with alacrity and with as little disturbance as is possible given the conditions.
All right, very, very good. Laura, would you like to add to what Margaret has said?
Sure. I think Margaret's definition is a great one. I actually found one that I really liked, ironically, from Psychology Today that I'm going to paraphrase, which is that resilience is that ineffable quality that allows some people to be knocked down by life and come back stronger than ever. Rather than letting failure overcome them and drain their resolve, they find a way to rise from the ashes. Even after misfortune, resilient people are able to change course and soldier on. And I really liked that because I think that that's very much what Margaret was describing, is that it's not the ability to bounce back to the previous state necessarily, but to build back or bounce back even stronger than ever.
Well, I think you both have done a very good job of defining what we mean by resilience. So now let's talk about some of the major natural threats to the resilience of human coastal communities, to families, to communities, to regions, and to infrastructure. Margaret, I want to start with you again, and then Laura can expand on your answer.
Sure. So I think the one that's most obvious, given recent events, is Mother Nature. be it storms like Katrina or Sandy, or the recent typhoon Haiyan. I think that how we deal with weather extremes and as weather extremes change into climate, I think that's one of the overarching challenges and opportunities that we have to demonstrate or to increase our resilience.
And?
Yeah, so I agree with Margaret. I think that's probably one of the greatest challenges of the current day as well as over the coming centuries. I also think that one challenge is how we as people can learn to better live with nature and to love our coasts without really loving them to death, which is kind of the trajectory that we've been on. So how can we as humans continue to enjoy the coasts but enjoy them in a way that's sustainable for generations to come?
So I guess our vulnerability is increasing because our coastal population is increasing. But what about the threats? Are they increasing? And if so, what are the driving forces? Laura, let's start with you on this one.
Sure. Well, as Margaret already mentioned, one of the major driving forces is climate change, and basically increases in sea level rise, changes in storm intensity, increased air and water temperature, and how those changes, also ocean acidification, affect human communities and natural resources, and of course those are interconnected. So, but it's important to note that it's not just climate change operating independently, it's climate change within the context of other global changes that we're starting to see, and changes in this country, increased population growth in coastal regions, people kind of migrating to the coastal areas because of all the benefits that they provide, increases in pollution, marine debris, and lots of other challenges for the coast. And so how these different threats kind of interact with each other is really what we're trying to understand and to plan for.
Margaret, would you like to add to what Laura has said?
Oh, well, I'd sort of like to give you a great example. We shape our natural exposure, our vulnerability, by where and how we have our footprint on the landscape. So where we site critical infrastructure, roads, water systems, sewer systems, all of that sort of determines the range of exposures that we will have, how we will design those concrete structures as communities, as business, and as individuals. That in turn is says something about our appetite for risk. And I want to emphasize Laura's discussion about the complexity. For instance, we don't always think about the drought that's gripping much of the country as being a coastal issue, and yet everything we know about watersheds and how watersheds work, by the time the drought is made manifest on the coast, the lack of water coming down the watershed, it adds another layer of complexity to both the natural systems and their ability to tolerate increased aridness or increased salinity. But moreover, Jerry, as you know, being in Southern California, drought increases your likelihood of wildfire, which in turn increases your likelihood of flash flooding and mudslides. So that's a great way that these things can come together and just deal us a difficult sandwich to eat.
All right, all good points. And now I would like each of you to look into your crystal ball and make some comments about the prospects for the future. Margaret, we'll start with you, and then Laura can add to it.
I think that, well, let me back up. I used to be a lawyer, and when I was early in my career, we used to have this construct called assumption of risk, which we seem to have lost sight of in this country. I think that our appetite for risk awareness, risk management in our household, in our businesses, in our communities, I think that's the one thing we all have to wrap our arms around. I do think that since Sandy, we've at least seen an increase in the public discussion about just these kinds of issues that we're discussing today.
Okay, Laura?
Sure. Yeah, I think that, I think it can be a little scary when you look at the trajectories and see how little change there is in some instances. But I also think I have reason for hope because I'm seeing a lot of bottom-up action from a lot of communities that basically don't want to lock themselves into an unsustainable future. And so they're having those hard conversations about how to enhance their resilience and to make some of those hard choices, but also take advantage of opportunities to do so.
So I guess my interpretation is that if we don't do things differently, that is, if we don't increase our resilience, then our vulnerability and our risks are going to increase in the future. That's for the human communities. What about natural communities, for the assemblages of plants and animals? What are the major threats they're confronting? And Laura, let's start with you on this one.
Sure. So I think the threats to natural communities in many cases are the same threats that human communities experience. And I think, non-climatic stresses like pollution, coastal development and other things like that are affecting natural systems. And so in many cases, these systems are already heavily degraded or depleted, which makes them then less resilient to climate variability and climate change. And so that's really what we're seeing now is that you have a lot of degraded coastal ecosystems that are also now being subjected to the impacts of climate change, and that can be really challenging. So as an example of recent changes that have been seen, where I used to live and work on the Oregon coast, starting in 2002 when I first arrived there, they had changes in ocean and wind conditions that led to dead zone, and many fish and crabs and other species were dying, washing up onto the beach, trying to flee the low oxygen waters. And now that's happened every single summer since then, and it hadn't happened before in over 50 years of scientific observation. So that's just an example of how sometimes these changes can be surprising, which kind of emphasizes the need for flexible and responsive management of natural resources.
Thank you. All right, now let's turn to strategies. What are some of the strategies for increasing the resilience of coastal communities? And let's start with human communities. And Laura, let's have you begin that.
Sure. I think that one area where we see a lot of promise in terms of enhancing resilience in a sustainable way is to use the protective benefits provided by natural systems, coastal ecosystems, to enhance the resilience of human communities. So we saw at least anecdotal evidence after Sandy that a lot of coastal communities that had invested in habitat conservation or marsh restoration or building up their dunes had fewer losses of property than did communities that didn't have those natural defenses in place. So that's really one area where we see a lot of interest is how can we integrate this green infrastructure or kind of habitats, coastal ecosystems into our gray infrastructure planning so that we have basically green and gray working together to enhance coastal resilience.
Margaret, would you like to add to that?
Well, I think that this is actually the point that Laura raised is very important because what we've tended to do in this country, generally speaking, is we identified our preferred development sites for our public infrastructure, water, sewer, roads, or for our next economic development park. Our next economic development park. And we do that historically without much attention to the environment in which it's situated. Where is it in the watershed? What is its relationship to wetlands or maritime forests or whatever systems are around us? And yet, if you really want to derive the maximum value of how well Mother Nature defends us, then you have to think about these things from the very beginning. That my example would actually be working with folks in Mobile, Alabama on the topic of community resilience. And we were actually looking at habitats in the area and the changing landscape in the large Mobile regional watershed. And even as we were discussing the importance of different wetlands versus other wetlands, the regional chamber of commerce director came up to me on the side and asked me a question about the currently designated 10-year floodplain and 100-year floodplain. And when we had a brief little discussion about how those lines came to be constructed and how those lines are also changing along with the increase in extreme high tide flooding that we're seeing on almost every coast, his comment to me was, well, you know, I was thinking of putting the new steel mill right there next to the 10-year floodplain line. And I said, well, that would make a lot of sense, because if you had a major storm, how are you going to get everybody to the steel mill? Do you have that many spare John boats? And within a very short period of time, the Regional Economic Authority had redirected the preferred development site for the new steel mill and all of its jobs to the edge of the currently designated 100-year floodplain. Now, it wasn't what I was thinking of as community resilience when we started engaging with that region on this discussion, but it certainly is a matter of resilience. So people's jobs are much more secure, the economic production of that plan is more secure, and that community has likely saved themselves a lot of disruption and money the next time a major storm comes through or they have some other big natural disaster.
Yeah, and I think what you've just described also underscores the importance of information, education, and outreach. How would the strategies change when we move away from human communities to natural communities, communities of plants and animals? And you might say a word about wetlands. In a rising sea, they've got to be able to move either laterally inland or to build vertically. Laura, what are the challenges for the natural communities?
That was going to be the example I was going to use, actually, is that we need to allow for space for wetlands to move. So if you have a road adjacent to a wetland, it's not going to be able to cross that road necessarily as sea levels rise. And so I think that's just one example of how we need to have the space for systems to be able to adapt. We have to enable that to happen. And another way to do that is basically to reduce the non-climatic stresses of ecosystems like pollution and other types of habitat degradation so that we can enhance their ability to adapt to climate change. Basically, by enhancing their resilience in general, we can give them a better shot at adapting as the climate changes.
So in some ways, it seems to me that the challenge is to design the coastal landscape of the future. Margaret, give us your thoughts.
I believe that we have to not just describe the landscape in the natural system sense, Jerry, but what we know from the science community is the communities that are the most resilient, they have the greatest ability to take a lick and keep on ticking, is the communities that also have very intact social, civic, and business networks. Those communities that already have a robust civic community are among the first to pull it together and recover from whatever event that they have been facing. So I think it's important to understand that we not only have to protect the environment because it protects us, the natural defenses that Mother Nature provides so much more cheaply than we can possibly construct with concrete, but we also have to pay attention to the nature and the quality of our social community and economic relationships within our communities and within our watershed, because that is also a part about being whole and resilient.
Good point. So I think one of the best ways to build nature and nature services is to work at building social capital, the interactions between and among people. So who has the responsibility for efforts to increase the resilience of local coastal communities? Is it local government, the states, the feds? Who? Margaret?
I would say that we all do, Jerry. Each of us has our own particular interests and capabilities, but I think one of the clearest messages, at least to me, of the last few years is in any country which seems not to fully appreciate the capabilities of the public sector or even the scientific community, that it then behooves us to understand and work with social and civic and community groups, both public but increasingly private. For instance, that's one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of the Business Civic Leadership Council of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, because they and all their member local chambers and the corporate foundations that support them are already beginning to recognize the importance of these very issues that we're discussing. When they first had this realization was after Katrina hit the northern Gulf of Mexico coast about a decade ago. And one of their observations was, even if they could maintain their own continuity of business operations, they could get back to business quickly. It didn't do them a whole lot of good if there was no one around in the community to buy their goods or services. So then they recognized that they were actually part of a greater system, their community, and they began to take these issues of community resilience and disaster risk reduction much more seriously. And over that last decade, I've seen them go from zero corporate foundations who have a funding portfolio along these lines to several dozen that do. So I think that often in a local community, the business sector is a very important component. We've also seen this in the climate arena. So even as our country, as a nation, as a whole, has not been able to articulate a very coherent or robust climate policy, and many of our states have not, yet over 900 of our local communities have. So there are 900 mayors, city or county councils or commissioners that have actually recognized the issues in front of them and stepped up to that.
You know, and it I would also point out that your very own Coastal America and the Coastal Ecosystem Learning Center Network is a network of 25 institutions, mostly all aquariums, spread around the coast, and they can also help in building this resilience. Laura, would you like to add anything to that?
Sure, yeah, I agree with Margaret in that we all share responsibility, and I think one of the mantras we use is think globally, plan regionally, act locally, because when it comes to issues like climate change, the impacts are going to be felt locally, and so there's going to need to be local initiatives to kind of enhance the resilience of communities to climate change. But there also need to be policies, best practices, communities of practice that share knowledge across boundaries and kind of help each other work together hand in hand to do this.
So we are making progress, and I think that we clearly need to make more and to accelerate what we're doing in a coastal zone to increase resilience. What did we learn from recent extreme events about community resilience? Sandy, or the severe drought that gripped Texas and much of the Southeast? In addition to what you've already said, are there some other lessons from those recent events? Margaret?
Well, yes, clearly, I'm going to cite New York. New York City has a very robust initiative right now. It's called Rebuild by Design, and they're looking for innovative, creative ways to deal with their environment, as well as the likelihood of rising sea levels and other challenges. And in fact, that they had already begun thinking about those issues was the reason that they had balloons to inflate several, although not all, of their subways since hit. The other thing that I think is very impressive is that the governor of New York has also recognized that there are a lot of people who've been living in low-lying areas, Rockaway Beach, other places like that, for a long time, who are on limited incomes. And he stepped out rather smartly, and the state of New York has a bond bill to make monies available to folks who want to elevate if they wish to stay where they are in a fairly hazardous environment, or to relocate. They're going to make buyout funds available at fair market value before Sandy hit. So elderly people, people of limited means, they will actually be able to have some options about where and how they face the future. So I think that that's a great example of how mayors and governors can bring together a community. Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, actually had a major commission that had a lot of people from both the private sector and the not-for-profit sector lead in the development of these very kinds of recommendations.
Laura, would you like to add to that?
Sure. I think recently, it's been kind of a wake-up call to this country that we are vulnerable to extreme weather and climate. And in 2012 alone, there were 11 different events that each resulted in over $1 billion in damages, for a total of $110 billion in damages over the course of the year. And so I think that's kind of a reminder that, you know, we are vulnerable and that this really is an economic issue. So it's not just a community sustainability issue, it's an overall issue for the economy, and it's both a challenge and an opportunity. I also think that in 2012, again, it was a reminder of how connected our coastal ecosystems are to the health and well-being of our coastal communities and economies. So, for example, Margaret already mentioned drought impacts in Apalachicola Bay, where I used to work, on the panhandle of Florida. They saw major population declines in their oysters because of drought and upstream water withdrawals. So because of the drought in the southeast, basically the fishery was collapsing, and then it resulted in a fishery disaster declaration. So this is, again, just a reminder of how connected our coastal populations and livelihoods are to our natural resources.
And I think the other takeaway lesson is how vulnerable and reliant we are on the nation's infrastructure, whether it's the electrical grid or water, wastewater, transportation. We are very vulnerable to the infrastructure. Well, we're getting near the end. I want to put up several slides that capture some of the points that you've made about what we need to do to increase resilience. And we can't spend very much time on them, but I invite either of you to comment on any of the bullets that you see up on the screen. Margaret, it's not like you to be lost for words.
Well, Jerry, I also want to build on a point that Laura made a moment ago, and that is that the cost of each of these kinds of events, Sandy or even lesser events, in an era of constrained fiscal resources, if we don't take action to make ourselves a more robust community, to increase our natural as well as our constructed resilience, these kinds of events actually take sorely needed funds away from other important issues like education or economic development or our public health or whatever is the issue that's of greatest concern to you. So I think the role of aquariums and other discovery centers is very important, because helping individuals in their communities and with their communities understand and address the kinds of risks that we are all exposed to is a very important part of the resilience process.
Thank you. Very, very good point. If we could put up those slides. We don't have time to go through all of these. These will be posted on our website. But I guess I would like each of you to comment briefly. Margaret, I want to start with you. A broadly shared vision of a sustainable future. It seems to me we have to have that at the national level, regional, and the local communities. What is it that we value, and what are we going to protect? What are your thoughts?
My view is that absent a vision, you cannot know where you are going. And as I alluded earlier, in the absence of thoughtful, articulate discussion at the national level, we increasingly look to regional and local efforts. And indeed, we have found that many people resonate most closely with the community around them, with the watershed that they're in. And I think beginning with that watershed, beginning with the discovery centers, the aquariums and the discovery centers, and helping people to understand the watersheds within which they live and derive their values is a great place to start us off to a better future.
All right, now I want to look at this slide again. That second bullet, accurate and timely data, information, and tools at decision-relevant scales. This is something that we all rely upon NOAA for providing to the nation. Would either of you like to comment on that?
I'm sure I will. I mean, I think at NOAA, we really see this, again, as an opportunity to better connect up our science with society. And so we're getting approached on a regular basis by citizens who want to know how to plan for future changes. And so they come to NOAA for our climate information, tools and services, as well as other types of information about coastal systems. And it's really been exciting to see, I think, the growing interest in the types of information that we provide, and also has really forced us to make sure that the science that we produce is actually usable by citizens working to plan for climate change.
Thank you. Margaret, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think I'll defer to Dr. Pettis.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to come back to that slide for just a second. The robust and collaborative planning process and the adaptive leadership, it seems to me those are both keys. We have to collaborate at the scientists and community leaders and planners. We have to have collaboration, cooperation, and we also have to have compromise in some of these things. And we have to be able to have adaptive leadership in an uncertain future. So I think we will leave the rest of those and we'll post them up on our website. But I would like to thank our two guests today. I think this has been a very good, lively, and important discussion. Margaret Davidson and Laura Pettis. And we hope that you will join us next month when we talk about ocean acidification. Ocean acidification is one of the most pernicious, persistent, pervasive impacts on the ocean, including coastal areas, and is probably one that is among the least understood by the general public. Dick Feely, who is a scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, and Bob Davidson, the director of the Seattle Aquarium, will be our guests for that program. I thank you again for joining us. I'm Jerry Schubel for Coastal Conversations.